Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I am your host, John DeLynn, in tennis shoes, and I'm very excited to have with us today someone that I've wanted to have on Mormon Stories for many years. His name is Benji Schwimmer. I know Benji because several years ago my family got into this TV show called So You Think You Can Dance. We started on season two, and it was in season two when a Mormon won the entire competition, and that was Benji. So You Think You Can Dance, for those who don't know, I think it's produced by the same people who produce American Idol, and it's just a fabulous show, really exciting. There are actually a couple Mormons, I think, on the show that season, and I just kind of fell in love with Benji from that time forward, and I've always wanted to interview him. Benji also has a big life outside of that TV show. He's been the world swing dance champion for, I think, 10 years plus running. He has a really significant dancing career. He's done some movie stuff. He's done music. He's done a lot of things in his career. But he's also willing to come on Mormon Stories Podcast. And so we're really excited to have him. So, Benji, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm really excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things we're going to cover today.
Yeah.
But I guess I want to give our listeners just a really heads up, a quick heads up, as to some of the things we'll be covering. Benji, we're going to talk about his dance career and what led to him becoming a world-class dancer. We're going to talk about what that's like to sort of be kind of a Mormon celebrity a little bit, and what the challenges and issues about that are.
Pseudo celebrity. Always pseudo, yeah.
Pseudo celebrity. We'll have to talk about what that means, but
the D list, the E list, the
okay. So like the A list. Who's the A list?
Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie.
Oh,
all that.
But who's the A list celebrity Mormon?
Oh, the Osmonds, I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you're a C?
Or Mitt Romney, I would say, now has taken that C.
So you're a B?
No, I would say I'm like a D.
A D?
Maybe.
All right.
Maybe a couple years back, I was a little bit higher. My stock's gone down a bit in popularity.
Well, we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk a little bit about his faith journey, and we're going to talk a bit about, in the Mormon vernacular, his sort of experiences with same-sex attraction. And we'll get more into that as we go, but I just wanted to give you guys a heads up from the beginning about kind of some of the things we're going to talk about. And most importantly, we're going to talk about where he is kind of spiritually now and his philosophies on life. So that's kind of at a big picture what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And let's just dive in. So, so Benji, let's begin with kind of your early Mormon story.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about your background, your ancestry as it relates to your early Mormon experience.
Okay, I'm a third generation Mormon from my mother's side. I was raised in Newport Beach, California. My mother lost her dad when she was 2 years old, and the missionaries shortly thereafter actually visited my grandmother along with five kids, and they converted. Everyone converted to the family. All of my aunts and uncles on my mom's side of the family are LDS. On my dad's side, he's a non-practicing Jew, and I have members of the Hell's Angels on the other side of the family, and so a very stark contrast between the Mormon side and the non-Mormon side of my family. My dad converted when I was 12, and so for the most part, my parents kind of raised me very lackadaisically in the Mormon church. We went to church on Sundays, but family prayer wasn't like a big prevalent thing in the home. My aunt, my mother's oldest sister, she was a very active Mormon. And in fact, most of my younger Mormon influence was usually based upon my cousins and them taking us to church or meeting with the whole family going to church together. That's kind of where we were at.
And what city was this?
Newport Beach originally.
And where is that?
That's in Southern California. Okay. United States of America, planet Earth.
Like near LA?
Yeah, it's about 45 minutes south on the coast of
But north
LA.
Of San Diego?
North of San Diego, in between LA okay. and right, San right. Diego, basically. And it's where the OC was filmed, in case people watch TV. Yeah, we were raised out there for a little bit. In fact, till I was 5 years old. And my parents decided to save some money, move into a new developing community that's a little less expensive. It's pretty expensive to live out there. And being both professional dancers, it's not a really lucrative business. So they decided to sell their dance studio and kind of pack up as my mom was pregnant with my little sister, Lace. And we moved to a little town called Moreno Valley, California. I want to say that was in 1990. And
where's that?
Moreno Valley is it's a very interesting town. It's probably from Newport Beach or from Los Angeles. It's about an hour and 15 minutes east.
Oh, okay. So it's east. Inland.
It's inland. It's called the Inland Empire for that reason. And I grew up in a very racially diverse school system. For the bulk majority of the time, I was a minority, being a Caucasian boy there. So I was raised around a lot of different kind of cultures, environments. Some of my best friends were African American. A lot were Hispanic as well, or Asian. And because of that, I was always kind of intermixed with a big select group of people. And granted, we always went to church for the most part. I remember getting baptized in my jacuzzi at 8 years old because my parents wanted to have all their friends that weren't members of the church to come and watch. And so they thought it'd be a little bit rowdy possibly for to put them inside of a stake center. And we got permission from the stake president to baptize me in my jacuzzi.
Nice.
Yeah, it was awesome. I remember I had to get baptized 3 times because I kept kicking my leg out of the water, and I just remember that memory pretty fondly.
Did your parents move there to set up a dance studio?
Yeah, that was the goal. My parents decided to save their money and to kind of maybe open up a dance studio in a budding community. At the time, a lot of people were moving into Moreno Valley. Actually, a lot of LDS people were moving into Moreno Valley at the time. I think that happens a lot, at least in the western half of the United States. There's a new community or project. Mormons tend to like to fill in groups. I mean, they kind of do these little exoduses, I believe, to just kind of build and start establishing stakes and this and that. And to this day, there's a lot of stake centers there in Moreno Valley. It's a tiny city, but there's a lot of LDS people and influence there.
So were your early years like hanging out at the dance studio while your parents were teaching people to dance? And
yeah, for the most part, actually, we didn't even have a dance studio for many years. My dad at the time was traveling around the world, kind of like I do now, actually, teaching and adjudicating at big dance conventions, weekend workshops, lectures, such as I do now. And my mom stayed with us half the time, and the other half the time we had a nanny who was LDS, and she would actually bring us to church a lot. And her family was very active in the church. And so I know when we went to a ward within a week, my parents met her in our sacrament meeting, and they said, "Do you want to be a nanny?" And she's like, "Awesome, let's do it." She was 18, just graduated high school, and she took care of my sister and I quite a bit. We call her Kimbo. And so Kimbo was pretty actually paramount, I think, in my spiritual upbringing as a child, just because she was the one that consistently had like a night prayer and read us scriptures. And we watched, we watched Saturday's Warrior together. We watched all sorts of fun little Mormon films that I still remember to this day, being from that influence so long ago.
So let's talk about the early dance stuff just really quickly. So, you know, I can think about like kids who are raised with dads who care about baseball or basketball or football, you know, like the Todd Marinovich, you're going to be a quarterback and giving the kid the sort of football when he's in the crib and raising him to be a pro football player.
Yeah, dude.
Were you raised to be a dancer, and what was your life like in terms of dancing as a young kid?
Dancing was pretty much everything that my family had. I mean, it's all that we did. There wasn't a moment where I wasn't probably in my room ripping clothes apart or stealing things from my mom and my dad and making like a ninja samurai warrior outfit to do a dance performance for my family. Or I was really into big old 80s dance movies, and I would play them in the background or play records at the time and do full-on shows for everyone in the neighborhood. I started an imaginary
band.
Which
movies?
Flashdance,
like
Staying Alive.
Dirty Dancing.
I hated Dirty Dancing at the time, but I love it now. Cynthia Rhodes is the bomb. She's the blonde one. She's awesome. But
Staying Alive, Dirty Dancing,
Flashdance, A Chorus Line. Those are probably my four
Saturday
top
Night
ones.
Fever.
Yeah, I like that one, but I was more into the 80s stuff.
Okay,
like
right.
Headbands, Rhinestones, Leg Warmers. I was all about it.
Okay, all right.
But on the flip side, too, I played soccer for 11 years. So it wasn't like I was just into the arts, but that was my focal point. That was what I did 24/7 for the
but
most
were
part.
Were your parents like, some of us are raising kids, right? And we're thinking, how do we raise our kids? Were they like, you're going to dance? And
you know what's funny is the biggest focus that my parents always gave me is they never stifled my creativity. If I said one day, and I was that kind of kid every week, I'm like, I want to be a fireman. Let's do that. They would buy me a plastic fireman's hat, and I would love that for a day. My parents never force-fed me, you will become a dancer. Never.
Never?
Never. They never once forced my sister or myself ever to dance. And it's something that I always wanted to do. When I was, the only time I ever did that, I think that there's the first video of me dancing was before I could walk, and my parents had a big dance camp that they had in the summer, and they were holding me. They took a Johnny Jumper. I don't know if you remember those little bouncy things that we used to sit in as kids, and they cut the cords off of the plastic bearings, right? And they did a little soft shoe routine, holding on to each side, and here I am bouncing my legs at like 18 months or something like that. Rhythmically, actually, which is kind of funny.
Do you have pictures of this?
I have video of this, actually.
Oh, I want to
see
that.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. But I remember the first time my parents took me to a big convention. As a little boy, I'd be 1 year old and blaring music, midnight, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, these big swing dance events or a ballroom event. And I'd be asleep under one of the little tables, like wrapped up in like my parents' sport coats and jackets. And so loud music, culture, older people, just dancing with adults was something that I just did as a little kid. And it was very natural to me, not talent-wise. As a dancer, I wasn't a very good dancer. Little videos of me as a kid, I was terrible, but I was a ham. I could perform anything and sell it. And I could get a standing ovation for a mediocre dance performance. But the performance aspect I was good at as a little kid. And dancing didn't start clicking with me in the physical kinetic aspect until I was about 17 or 18.
Okay, wait a minute. So were you like at some point saying, I want to be a great dancer, I want to really work at this? When did that start?
Yeah, going out through school, I always wanted to be an anesthesiologist. I don't know why, but I wanted to do it. I thought I was going to go to medical school. I thought I was going to use dance. As a little kid, I wanted this. I wanted to be a doctor. Just because everyone used to say, oh, being a doctor is the hardest thing you can do. The schoolwork is so difficult. And I'm like, I'll do it then. And I always wanted to prove people that I could do something, I guess. And I guess that had a lot to do with it. So growing up, I was always dancing. I was always doing dance competitions as a little boy. And I loved doing it.
But not because you wanted to be a dancer.
No, I loved doing it, but I thought it was going to be something that I would do as a kid. Maybe use it as a scholarship to go to the Y.
How much would you practice in a given week?
As a little kid, not as much. I would dance on my own more than anything. I would play those 80s dance movies and dance my heart out all night.
When did you start training or practicing?
I started training a lot, during my adolescence, like 12, 13, 14 through 16.
Okay, so in your late, 8, 9, 10, you weren't like in the studio?
No, we didn't even have a studio at the time.
Okay.
And so my parents actually laid out stick tile. I remember this black and white checkered stick tile in our garage. And they would just, have all their tapes and records at the time, and I would just play them. And they just let me go. I mean, they never had to really hire a babysitter for myself.
And you just loved it.
I loved it. Loved it all. And I would watch movies. I was really inspired by the most random films and the most random styles and this and that.
Like, would you put a TV up and dance to the TV?
All the time. I would
give
actually,
us some examples of a routine.
For instance, so Staying Alive, it's part two to Saturday Night Fever. It's rated as one of the worst sequels of all time.
Yeah.
John Travolta
headband.
Started. Headband, loincloth,
yeah.
Leg warmers.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. It was so much fun. And it was theoretically, it's actually a really racy movie. And as a little boy, I would just fast forward and watch all the dance parts. As a little boy, I was also, my parents took me when I was a little kid to Follies Bergère in Las Vegas, which is a topless dance show, but it wasn't a striptease. It wasn't something like that. My parents, at a very early age, I think I had a big taste of adult contemporary art and the value in that and not confusing that with vulgar, explicit sexuality. That has always been something that I was very exposed to at a very young age. I was exposed to gay people. I was exposed to drinking. Never drank. My parents never drank. I've never seen my parents ever hold a glass of wine. And in fact, in pictures, if someone's like, can you hold this really quick? They would do this. even when my dad was not LDS, he converted when I was 12. He never drank. Never once did a drug. Nothing. My parents were really cool about that, actually. Very, very word of wisdom in that moment. Anyways, I digress. But yeah, so John Travolta does this big performance at the very end where it's a battle between heaven and hell. And so I took this really ugly brown towel that we had, I think from like, I want to say it's from the DI or something, Desert Industries. It's like a thrift store for the church, in case those that don't know. But and I cut it up. And I wore it, like I would wear like my Snoopy underpants, right? And I would put my, my loincloth over it, I'd wear the headband, and I learned the whole routine. Like at 10 or 11 years old, I did the whole routine that he did.
In your garage?
Yeah, in my little garage. And we moved later on, like when I was 13, I believe we moved to another house where there was like a little dance room, we had mirrors and everything. And I would literally till 11, 12 before I had to go to bed to go to school. I would finish my homework really quick and just do it and just dance and sweat. And then I would play ballroom competitions of like the top world champions, and I would see them spin really fast. And I'm like, I want to learn that. So most of my training actually came from just visually looking at TV performances, music videos. Michael Jackson was obviously the biggest influence that I had. And I remember at four, this is a funny story, at 4 years old, my dad, from a student of his, had extra tickets to go to a Michael Jackson concert in LA at the Universal Amphitheater. And I was elated. Like at 3 years old, I did a live impromptu performance at, which is, it's called the US Open Swing Dance Championships, which is our world championships in swing. And it's funny because 14 years later, I would win that competition, but before, and I couldn't even compete, I was too young. And I actually asked the person that was the MC in the middle of a competition, can I do a dance performance? I snuck out of my parents' table. They were talking to somebody, and I put on this rhinestone headband, right? And these glasses with the little cuts through them. And I put on this red jean jacket and like a tie-dye t-shirt and black skinny jeans, kind of like this, and these sparkly Converse. I remember this. And I asked him, I'm like, I need to do a performance. He's like, let the kid perform. And so I said, what do you want to dance with? Bad, Michael Jackson. I want to do Bad by Michael Jackson.
So you would imitate the actual
totally.
Dancing.
Yeah, I was terrible. I had a head, the size of my head, I have a large head to begin with. And my body was really tiny. I think my head was the same size then as it was now, as it is now. And anyways, to make a weird story short, I remember going in front of 1,500, 2,000 people and having him wait. He said, here he is, little Benji Schwimmer, Buddy and Laurie's son. And then I refused to walk out till he called me Michael Jackson. And I tugged on his jacket, like, you have to call me Michael Jackson. So until he said that, 2 years later, I'm at the concert, and he says, Michael, I went home and I told my mom, I'm like, Michael Jackson spoke to me. He said, he talked to me. And my mom's like, no way, are you kidding me? My dad was doing this. Like, no, he just said hi to everybody. Like, I love you. I love you. You know, Michael does that. And so from then on, I thought Michael Jackson spoke to me and I was supposed to be like a mega star performer like him. I always wanted to do that. I started my own band when I was five. But no one would play, and no, I didn't play any instruments. So I had a fake microphone, and I had these little stop signs and yield signs that were about this tall that I would write my little scooters around as a little boy, and I would put wigs on them. And I would perform. I had a band called the Cherry Bomb Sparklers Band, and I would write songs and sing. And I thought I was a megastar. I would have concerts for all the kids in my block as a little boy.
So your creativity came from just your own self-entertainment.
Yeah.
Just your own self-exploration.
Yeah, you completely.
So there was never this point in your late, you know, 8, 9, 10, early teen years where your parents were like, you need to dance and I want you to get good at dance, and
no,
you know, why aren't you practicing, you ever practiced?
No, in fact, I did partner dancing at first. I would freestyle and do this by myself, but I was never really trained in contemporary ballet, hip-hop, any of that. So I would just freestyle like Michael Jackson, dance around, copy my mom. She was a jazz dancer and a ballerina and a gymnast. My dad was a hustle ballroom swing dancer. Like, he used to like pop and lock. He used to do all these things back in the disco era. And of course, I think parents, you know, they want to see you follow in their legacy and footsteps. And more than anything, I had more pressure, I think, from other people, outside influences, saying, gosh, you need to stick with this, you're so adorable. Or I love the audience. I didn't care to win competitions. I wasn't passionate. I'd never been competitive about beating other people. I think one time in all my life, I've actually walked into a competition saying, I want to beat this person.
So what was the drive?
The drive was that standing ovation, I think.
Loving approval?
Maybe loving approval.
Or making people happy? What was
it? I think more than anything, entertaining people. Whether it was in front of 5,000 people at 11 in Germany doing a family performance that we did, or in front of just three people, or even at church. I remember I was in junior high in woodshop class, and I hated my teacher. It was his last year before he was about to retire. He didn't like me because I was hyperactive and I was always dancing around, but I was always getting my work done. I was a straight A student up until the time I was in high school. And in fact, I was 2 years ahead. I graduated at 15 from high school. So it wasn't something that I neglected that side of work because I thought I was going to be a doctor. You know, I always said that in the back of my mind. And anyways, I remember he used to yell at me and say, you know, get your work done early. And I said, fine. And one time he just started chewing me out in the class saying, you know, you got to stop moving around and dancing. You can hurt something. And I'm like, okay. And so finally we came to an agreement that if I get my work done and not, if I sit still for 45 minutes of an hour class, he'll let me do a performance of stand-up comedy, a dance piece, or he would let me freestyle rap for 5 minutes, the last 5 minutes of class. And I would.
And you love that. Why?
That was hysterical. You know, I was pretty popular to a good group of kids in elementary school. But at the time, in that era, being a dancer was not cool. And very early on, there were always a couple of weird, heinous comments. Obviously, there's a taboo and a stigma being a male dancer that you're gay, or that you're effeminate, or that you're girly. You want to be a girl. And it's funny because I never identified that way. Like, I never identified me being effeminate or being, like, I played sports. I played basketball with my buddies. You know, I had girlfriends. And it wasn't that for me at all. It wasn't my way to express myself or anything like that in any way, shape, or form. And, but I remember in particular, there was one moment, there's two kind of like traumatizing moments that I had growing up in school that really did me in. And that made me realize that I almost wanted to prove people wrong in all aspects. I wanted to be that male dancer that was a strong male dancer that was funny and entertaining, but that was the good Mormon boy that did everything right. I mean, there was this really weird contrast because people thought I was this wacky kid that would wear weird color ties to church. And so I was never fully accepted in church. I was always kind of viewed as a character or as this oddball that some even parents said stay away from him at an early age. Even though I was passing the sacrament, I was a good boy, you know. And on the flip side, I was at school and I was this wacky kid there too. So junior high era, sixth grade in particular, it got really, really bad. I was made fun of a lot. I didn't have my growth spurt for another like 2 years. So everyone started growing ahead of me and I got bullied so much. I mean, there wasn't a day.
For what?
For being a dancer or
so
just
kids
being different.
At school knew you were a dancer.
Yeah, I mean they totally knew I was a dancer. It's something I never hid. I was not that kid to be. And there's a lot of closet dancers, we say, that grew up. I mean, one of my closest friends, he's a great swing dancer, champion dancer, and he played volleyball and basketball in school, and he never once told a soul. It's different now with YouTube and with media. Like, you can't hide that. And then again too, it's kind of cool to be a dancer now. It's actually really cool to be a dancer now. So. But at the time, it was considered gay and bad. And
but you were, I'm just trying to get a sense, you know, I have my kids and I'm always thinking about their development and I'm always wanting to encourage them to be excellent at something. And mm-hmm. I hit roadblocks, right?
Yeah.
And I realize what I'm hearing you say is that your excellence hasn't come from parents pushing. It's
no.
More like they put you in an environment, they give you an example, they give you exposure and lots of nurturing. And then you define it.
They gave me an open palette and they gave me every color that I could paint with. That's what my parents did for me. We didn't have a lot of money growing up. I mean, we struggled. You know, a dancer's life is not as glamorous as it may seem. Like, you look at all the rhinestones on the floor and each one of those rhinestones was 25 cents and we glued it ourselves and we would recycle them. I, as a little boy, to have rhinestones on my costume sounds really weird, but to have rhinestones or whatever on my costume, I would literally go to ballroom competitions as a little boy, wait till they were done. And I would pick up the ones that had fallen and put them in like a little bag. Yeah, I mean, they have a street value. You know, it's like crack cocaine. You know, like, those things are pretty expensive.
So in sixth grade, you're self-identifying as a dancer, but not because you want to become a a professional dancer because you want to become a doctor.
Yeah.
So what are you? Why are you even self-identifying? You're dancing in your garage.
That's what I did.
You're not competing.
I competed at the time.
Okay, so you were competing by junior high.
By 5 years old, I was competing.
Okay, so you were competing the whole time.
Yeah, and I would win. I would win money. You know, a fifth place check still gave you $50, and that was pretty cool.
But you weren't training. Like formally training?
I wasn't taking deep classes. What we would do, there would be maybe one swing dance. At the time, swing dancing was an adult person sport. It wasn't something that kids did. And I was one of three couples in the United States that competed. And it was always just between us three couples every year. And it would only be, there would only be one event, maybe two events throughout the year that we would compete. So it wasn't something that we were like training, you know, every week. It's not like an ice skater where they have an ice skating competition every other weekend.
Right.
It is now. But it wasn't like that.
Where you're like
then.
5 hours in the studio.
Right. Training. But they also had sponsorships. Like, it was expensive. We couldn't even be out at certain hours because people would be smoking and drinking. And in fact, a lot of the swing dance crowd, they would love us. They would clap for us on the floor. But a lot of professional dancers said, this is not a place for a kid to be.
Okay.
There's a lot of drunken behavior. You know, like most people would social dance till 4 a.m. and if you weren't plastered with at least a couple of shots of whiskey in you, then you weren't a swing dancer at the time. My parents were like the antithesis to that. And because they were so different and they were considered oddballs in everything that they did, right? A ballerina marrying a disco dancer and they're dancing swing and ballroom.
Right.
And doing jazz performances and going to Vegas and choreographing for professional TV shows and this and that. They were the oddball. So I identified as, it's okay to be different. It didn't bother me, you know, to be this and that. And I think there's always this duality. Like I was a dancer, but I probably knew that I would someday become a doctor. And the reason why is because we were so poor. I wanted to be able to help support my parents. You know, we weren't going to have a retirement. I learned that in school pretty quickly. You know,
right.
We don't have, you know, a pension plan or insurance. And that was a tough thing to deal with whenever someone was hurt or injured. I mean, it was something where it's like, you know, we're going to have to scrap and save pennies. This
right.
happened frequently, you know, or help from the church or dinners from the Relief Society. This happened quite a bit. My parents, I remember my dad got into a really bad car accident and his knees were busted. The steering wheel crushed both of his kneecaps. Mm. I mean, that's our bread and butter right there. And so this is when I was 13 years old. And that was the day that my mom, you know, she actually had a very bad health issue at the time. She was suffering from a very weird version of vertigo. She couldn't teach dance. And literally at 13, I taught my very first dance lesson. Mm. And at 13 years old, that's when the bug started hitting me to kind of pursue this and to be a little bit more passionate about it. I would go to this bar called the Branding Iron in San Bernardino, California. My mom would, or a babysitter would drop me off, and I would teach all adults at a drunken cowboy bar till midnight.
And get paid.
But all that money went to the family. That went to food on the table.
Okay.
I didn't save up for anything. That was money to help my family out for a good 6 months. And then, but because of that, when my dad healed during those 6 months, he wasn't working yet. I actually took over a lot of his gigs and I actually started getting my own following. Had my own class at 14 weekly in our garage that we had. And then little by little, that helped us actually develop a clientele big enough to open up a dance studio.
So that tragedy sort of led to
to
some of the more important parts of your formative career.
Again, proving it wrong, proving people wrong that we're not going to fall on our butts here, but we're going to survive.
Okay, so you were competing from a young age.
Yes.
And you were dancing in competitions all along.
Yes.
But not like training 5 hours a day in a formal studio. Like
that didn't happen until I was 13.
Okay.
13 or 14.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So you were telling us a story about in sixth grade, something people were making fun of you.
Yeah. I mean, every day I was pushed into lockers. I mean, it was literally that atypical like bullying situation. It got to a point where any physical activity, I walk in the hall, people would throw food at me and call me faggot. And
so they were calling you gay?
From that point on. Yeah.
Was it because you were a dancer or because they thought you acted gay?
Probably both. Not gay in the sense of an effeminate man, but gay in the sense that I was artistic. If there was a song in my head, whether it was a rap song or a pop song, I'd whistle it or I'd sing it walking down the halls in school. It didn't bother me. I didn't care. I never let anyone stifle my creativity. The only people that I think that could have done it were my folks, my parents, and they never did. So why do I care if Joe Blow, little idiot, you know, is making fun of me? It didn't really bother me that much. It didn't make me change.
But you paid a price for it.
Paid a huge price. And it got to a point for a year, I took it. I let everyone just kind of bully me around. I would avoid the situation. I got into a fight at least once a week, literally once a week. And then the growth spurt hit. And then I got a little like, maybe it was the pubescent aggressive behavior that sometimes we have, but then I started fighting back. And so it went from less of like, you're a fag, you're gay, to the, you know, the slurs of bullying about being gay. And it was more about just weirdo, more about being dancer kid and weird this and that. And so it died down a lot more because I would punch back. I was very easy to verbally respond and put people down. And in fact, it was encouraged by one of my I think it was the vice principal at the time of my junior high. She told me, she's like, you need to find a way to stop fighting physically and just squash it. And so I did. It's going to sound really weird, but I became a TA to avoid a lot of those conflicts. She let me be a TA for like three periods in junior high.
A teaching assistant?
Teaching assistant.
Okay.
So I would assist video production. So I started playing with cameras, and I actually started doing, we had these like morning announcements that were played every morning live, and I would both press the record button
and run around,
read the announcements, press a video that I made the day before to entertain people, the credits, I would dub music, and I made a side business off of it, because if someone liked somebody, I would like charge them $5 on the side and like have them, and I would put all that money to like dance stuff. Like I would always consistently find weird ways to like take care of myself and survive.
So always an entertainer.
Always.
So what did you think about homosexuality in sixth grade or seventh grade or eighth grade? Did you even think about it? How did you think about it yourself?
I knew what gay was at five. So before even that, I knew what gay was. And at the time, we had lots of gay friends. My parents had so many gay friends. I mean, dance community, come on, artists. You know, there's a good chance that 90% of them, if they're men, are gay, especially if they're single. So, you know, I knew gay people from the get-go. It wasn't a big deal. But I also, there was this weird duality with me. And this is a very traumatizing experience, but I think it's actually pretty poignant with the rest of the story. The day I was baptized, right? I had, at the time, I think when I was 5 years old, I remember I had a crush on my best friend. I'm not going to name his name because people would probably know who that is.
When you were how old?
Five.
Okay.
And guy. So I knew then that I was different in that sense. And I knew that a lot of the boys and girls didn't identify that way. But on the flip side too, I had girlfriends that I was infatuated with. So it was this both. To me, I just kind of liked people. I liked certain people for their candor, or the way they dressed, or the way they played sports, or the way that they colored on a coloring book. There was always something that I liked about people. It wasn't just this gender identifying thing as a child. And I think a lot of children are like that to begin with before adolescence kind of sets in. But I remember one time, my best friend at the time, we were in, ironically, the same jacuzzi that I got baptized in before I was baptized. And I remember his big sister was babysitting us at the time. And as some kids do, there is an element of experimentation that happens to straight kids, it happens to gay kids, it happens to many people. And there was this curiosity of like playing doctor, kind of. We'll just leave it at that.
With a male friend?
Yes, with my
at
best.
At age?
Five.
Okay.
Or six at the time, maybe even seven.
Okay.
But this kind of happened not very often. It was very innocent. It was never sexually driven in any way. I was five or six. I mean, come on, you know. But there was an element of experimentation and curiosity that I was really infatuated with. And I figured, well, since we're best friends and we're boys, we must be boyfriends. That was my mentality. You know, like that was my logic as a kid. But I didn't put being boyfriends as being gay. Like I didn't identify the two, because I thought being gay was being these flamboyant dancers that I'd met that would dress in drag and do performances at our dinners with family, or I don't know, that had these funny accents and these bent wrists. And I didn't identify that. We used to play basketball together, me and my best friend, and we went to church together, like we were in Sunday school together. So it was never an issue for me at the time. But the day of my baptism, I got baptized, and I was very closely in age with my best friend at the time, who was getting baptized like a month later. So he and his family were there, and that same sister that was babysitting us, I guess, had watched us and saw what we were doing. And she was trying to she had mentioned one thing after I got baptized, and my cousins were like, you know, congratulations, Ben, you're a man now, and, you know, you're a member of the church. It's so awesome. I was so happy to be baptized. And and remember, she walked in, and I don't know if she's trying to flirt with him or act cool. She was like 17 at the time. She's like, he doesn't deserve to be a member because he's a faggot. And she's like, I saw him kissing my brother in the jacuzzi whenever, a while back. And I remember, like, just throat closed up. And I didn't know what to say. I just, white as a ghost. I'm in front of, like, my two cousins that were about to serve missions that I looked up to dearly. And she said this. And I'm sure they don't even remember this story. I'm sure it was just like, oh, shut up. I remember he brushed it off. He's like, whatever. Like, shut up. Yeah, whatever. You're a liar. And thank heavens, like, he brushed it off. But to me, in that moment, there was this, I don't know, the seed planted in my head, this trauma, theoretically, where I would prove people wrong that I wasn't gay, that I wouldn't let them know that I could be that dancer, that good Mormon boy that was baptized. I understood the element of being a sinner very quickly at 8, you know, what is good, what is bad. And I identified as being a faggot in that moment. That's how it was said to me in that moment, as being bad. I remember something was said that I would burn in hell and this and that. And, you know, there's this weird thing that was built up inside me that I would never let anyone know about this. In fact, even that best friend, I'm like, when we walk around with each other, like, we remain friends for a little bit after that, maybe another 2 years. But even then, like, in junior high, I needed to distance myself from him because I didn't want people to suspect anything.
That something had happened.
Or that I was gay.
Did you think of yourself internally did you suspect that you might be, or did you not even go there consciously for yourself?
It would be like in those moments when you're an active member of the church that's faithful, and maybe every once in a while you would question something briefly.
Is it true? Could it be true?
Yes, very, very much so like that. And the funny thing was, is I had girlfriends. In those moments, it didn't matter. But then again, like, I was really close to some of my male friends as well. And I was always infatuated with one for some reason. But at the time, it wasn't sexual, right? It would always be that term homosexual. And I'm like, well, I'm not thinking about anything bad, or I just like his teeth. I had braces at the time, you know, or something like that. Something that I didn't have that they had, that I admired in them. Or he plays soccer better than I do. Or, I don't know, he's really smart in math. Whatever it was, there was something that identified this polar attraction to them.
But not sexual necessarily.
No. That didn't happen until mid-adolescence, yeah.
Just interest or affection.
Yeah.
In a global sense.
In a global sense. In a very universal appeal. Yeah. The same way that, you know, guys can say, I have such a man crush on that dude because he's just so cool. He's got it together.
Really respected. Really deep love and respect.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And appreciation.
Romantic. Okay. Less than all romantic.
Right. All right. So you, there was this kind of like occasionally, whoa, I wonder if, but no, I'm not. And so you would
Say, you know what? That's something that I'm never going to address.
You're just not going there.
The moment that I'm like, oh, I guess I'm kind of gay. Nope. Mm-mm.
Okay.
Shut up.
Okay.
up, Benji.
Got it. Yeah. And you were attracted to women.
Very much so.
By the time you hit puberty, you...
Prior to that.
...would get aroused being with a woman.
Yes.
Okay. So...
Totally. Okay. Holding hands with a girlfriend. Sixth grade. I remember this one girl. Definitely. I was infatuated. We'd hold hands and I would be like holding a gym book in front of me.
Right.
I don't know if that's too inappropriate to say.
Yeah, I got it. I think we got it.
Okay.
Did you get it?
Sorry, it happens. So.
Okay, so let's switch tracks a bit to what the church meant for you in your teen years up to your mission.
That's great, yeah. Again, my parents weren't the most devout members of the church in terms of tithing was never really paid. I'd never had a family home evening in my life. The only times we'd have something remotely like that was when a visiting teacher or someone from the Relief Society would come over or whatever, or a home teacher would come over. And that was rare too, because at the time it wasn't pushed as hard, especially where we lived. And but we would still go to church at least once or twice a month, sometimes like devoutly. And in particular, if my parents were gone, I would always go with my babysitter, my nanny at the time. And so, you know, I got the priesthood at 12, just like everyone else. I had callings. And I remember one thing that was really interesting is I remember seeing the boys in church, the ones that had the perfect parted hair, that had the perfect square regal royal knot that I mastered on my mission, but I don't do now because I think it looks really bulky and ugly. Anyways, I remember like they, for some reason, would get called to be the president of like the teacher's quorum. or the deacons. And that's something that I never got. I was always this goofy kid. But in class, I think I was fairly reverent, and reverent, not irreverent. And I loved reading the scriptures. And I loved going to church, and I loved singing the hymns, and I loved bearing my testimony more than anything. There was something about bearing my, where I felt like I wasn't on. I wasn't trying to entertain people. It was just something that I devoutly, divinely felt at the time. And as a little boy, I had spiritual experiences that I remember very, very wonderfully still to this day. Now, can it be explained
like
in different ways?
Ones that you're comfortable...
At this point, I'll throw anything out there, really. But I remember there was a couple of experiences as a boy. I remember at probably 10 years old, I was sitting there, and it was the... I remember I was gone too long. I didn't attend church. I was traveling with my family in Europe doing dance shows for a month, and it was during, like, the primary preparation presentations. So I think they let me go up there and quote an article of faith or a scripture or something, and I walked back down and I watched. But I remember when, like, the sunbeams, like, the younger kids were singing... what's the song? I know it in Spanish. Go figure.
What is it?
In Judea. Oh, baptism. The song Baptism. The primary hymn, like in Judea, the Baptist.
Jesus came to
John the Baptist in Judea long ago. And I remember crying my eyes out and remembering the fact that maybe I'd done things bad before I was baptized, even though I wasn't even at the age of accountability. But I remember the stuff that I did with my best friend. Right, and I remember remembering my baptism and hearing them sing and hearing the purity in their voices, and something about that touched me. I mean, I'm getting like touchy, like a little emotional about it now. So random.
What happened?
I just was touched. I just remember hearing that and feeling like an overwhelming sense of peace, like that I made the right decision. And it wasn't even like a decision at the time. Like, you know, it was very... this is what I'm doing, you know. But I remember I had a strong influence from both my babysitter, from my mom's side of the family, especially my aunt and uncle and my cousins. In particular, my cousin Heidi, who I danced with for almost 19 years. You know, she was like a big sister to me. We lived together and spent more time together than I think even my little sister Lacey and I did for earlier parts of my life. And you know, she would read her scriptures and she would talk about seminary when I was not her age. She was a little older than I am. Although I shouldn't say that, she'd be killing me right now for saying it. But I remember being touched like that as a child. I remember going up and bearing my testimony and feeling peaceful about talking about, you know, families can be together forever, and loving that idea. And maybe it was because my family wasn't the perfect LDS cookie cutter family that I thought everyone else in that room was. Looking back, I laugh, you know. Looking back, I laugh because I was made fun of so much by so many kids in church. And then, you know, there was that 50-50, and I think that's always how church is always going to be, you know. And I think there was a talk a few years back in conference where it talked about, you know, only half of you that claim to be active members really are probably going to make it. And I believe in that. I believe that about half the members of the church really have always stuck out and have been like, have really been good, true Christians, in my opinion, or at least to me and my family. You know, being a little bit of an outsider, a little different, and maybe the other half is a bit more Pharisaic, but yeah. So there are many moments like that growing up where I did that, and I always just desired to strive to be a little bit more like those boys that were getting called to be the deacon's representative or quorum advisor. I don't know what they name it now, but I wanted that. Like, I wanted to be someone that was accepted well in the church, and I felt like my talents could be well used there.
What role did the law of chastity and word of wisdom play in your teenage years?
It was everything. I was a, quote unquote, I was a good Mormon boy. I'd never broken the law of chastity or the word of wisdom. I can faithfully say that.
Up to your mission?
Yeah, and then after. If we're talking just prior to going to my mission, never. Never once. Never something that was really an issue. I was a good boy. I really was. Like, I had attractions to boys, and I felt weird about that, but I never really exercised them, ever. I mean, the physical sense. So, never did.
And you kept it clean with the girls?
I kept it clean with the girls. I did at times, and I always felt good about it. I felt like I was doing good when I made out with a girl, when I kissed her. Like, there wasn't any petting or touching or anything like that, but if there's ever a moment to play spin the bottle or to kiss a girl or to hold her hand in public, I loved it. I felt like I was scoring straight points. too. So it was like a double whammy. My parents were always like, go Benj. They were always really trusting of me. My parents were more big older friends to me. Like the whole thing, they let me create. They let me put weird makeup on. They let me do weird shows like that. I kind of laugh about my mom. I'm like, they never once suspect that I was gay as a kid. And yet I have a video of me at 12 years old in drag dancing to Rolling on a River, performing for my whole family and them crying, laughing.
Did high school friends ever ask you about?
You know, my friends never questioned anything. My friends were the ones that said, he's weird, he's goofy, he's a nerd, he's creative, and they liked it. And that's all that mattered. And I had girlfriends with them. I dated almost every girl that I was friends with at one point, or had like a deep crush on them, always. And my guy friends would be like, yeah, he's a little weird, but I mean, seventh, eighth grade, ninth grade, middle of, you know, high school, junior high era, a lot of my friends would step up and fight for me. I mean, they were good kids. And it was partially Mormon, but more, I was actually more with the born again Christian crowd. I wasn't really good friends, with the exception of a couple of girls. The Mormon boys I wasn't really friends with growing up in junior high. I think it's because I was different, and they didn't like that. So I actually had more, they never made fun of me, but they just ignored me in school. But the born-again Christians were always encouraged to especially save the Mormons. So I would always like have good friends in them, randomly enough.
Right.
So I felt that kind of interesting.
So talk about what the church meant to you up to your mission.
So my parents, again, were never stifled the fact that I went to church. Like there were moments I had, I started trying to go to seminary and that was really tough because sometimes, you know, I would go to school throughout the day, eat dinner with the family, do homework, and then I would dance till midnight. Or teach
in your
class.
Once you started teaching.
Now we have a dance studio. Yeah, okay. And so it was a family business, and my parents couldn't pick me up from school. I was rollerblading to from school to house to do homework, to feed my dogs, to do chores, and then to come to the dance studio and teach classes for a couple hours, then train for a couple hours with my dance partner. My dance partner Heidi and I, we would stop rehearsing sometimes to 1 a.m. I was obsessed. We were possessed.
Trying to win national championships?
Yeah, trying to win national championships, trying to get better. We started really late in going into ballroom dancing, too. And that was something that we were really, really passionate about. And, so that it was kind of interesting. You know, I was just driven.
The seminary was hard to do.
Seminary in the morning was hard to do, but I did make up seminary. I did seminary independently. I did independent study seminary when I would travel on trips, mostly in airports and airplanes and in hotel rooms. I would be reading the scriptures and filling them out and, like, filling these booklets that they have out.
What role did prayer and scripture reading play in your teenage adolescent years?
As a kid, I would always feel really guilty for not being the best prayer person. There were times where I would literally get home so exhausted, I would fall asleep on my knees trying to pray, but I would just be out cold, Heavenly Father, and just be dead, you know? And but prayer has always been a big thing. Before I would ever dance in class or before every dance competition, I remember I would pray by myself. I would pray with my cousin Heidi. Prayer has always been something really good. At the time, my parents, and I think it's okay to say this, they were not doing good between the two of them relationship-wise. And there was a lot of fighting at night. And I would be protective of my little sister more than anything. And I would just pray that things would be okay because I wanted our family to be together forever. They weren't sealed in the temple together. My dad had still, I think, the Aaronic priest. I think he still does. And that was really difficult. And it was really weird because they were, my dad and my mom are like legends in the dance community. I mean, they can do no wrong. They know more than
nationwide?
Anyone.
Nationwide?
Worldwide.
Worldwide.
They're renowned.
Your parents?
Yes.
What are their names?
Buddy and Lori Schwimmer.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, everyone thought they were this perfect couple amongst the dance community. No one would know anything until they would come home. And there would be so many fights and so many differences of opinion. And it was terrible. And, you know, most of the time, I think a lot of the fights came from money, you know, and it's something that we just never had enough of. And that was partially why I always had this desire. I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to make a buttload of money. I'm going to pay for my parents to have like these awesome retirements. I'm going to have insurance. I'm going to have kids and they can dance and they can live the dreams that I wanted to have as an adult. But I'm going to be a doctor. That was my idea. And or maybe I could be an anesthesiologist, shoot up somebody, go dance for a little bit, wake them up. I mean, that was my little ignorant boy mentality, I think. But going back to prayer, there were times in my life, for instance, when my dad hurt himself in his knees, where my family would have these family prayers. But they would be these epic prayers where we would sit down and we would all pray. Like it would be, my mom would pray, and then she would call out my name, and I would pray. And we would do these, which is something that's kind of unheard of for the most part. Yet for some reason, we all did it in moments of really deep trial, and where my family needed to stick together. And I remember those moments I would cry.
What did that mean to you guys?
I remember those moments as the most humbling moments for my family. You know, in a dance community, we were like, people call us the swing dynasty. You know, like, because my dad was this big swing dancer. My grandfather was a Harvest Moon Ball winner, which is before swing dance competitions. I mean, that's, Fred Astaire used to compete in that competition. We had like a little legacy going on. Even if it made nothing material-wise, money-wise, we had this legacy in these communities. And yet going in home to a humble house in a little town, I think a lot of the times my creativity stemmed from the fact we didn't have a lot of money, so my mom would take me thrift store hunting. All of my clothes are from thrift stores. And so I'm like, well, if I can't buy the new cool things, like I'm going to make these weird, wacky, like disco outfits. I would wear like vintage Angel Flight, like bell bottoms, and or dress like an 80s dancer. Not like full on rhinestones or anything, but I would dress wacky and goofy. And I thought I was like the Jim Carrey of my junior high and high school half the time. Really.
And prayer, it was a humbling thing.
For our family. And I remember those moments as the most spiritual moments of my family, where we really did rely on the divine to get us out of these tough times. And we always did. You know, there would always be that silver lining or that miracle that would happen somehow, where all of a sudden my dad got a phone call a couple of days later, can you come to Europe and teach a couple lectures?
Just like they say in church, right? Well, just like in sacrament meeting.
Yeah, I mean, trial by faith, prayer, James 1:5. Like, it always happened for us. It
what was your relationship did. With Heavenly Father? What? Did you feel like you had one? What did he mean?
I think for a boy my age, looking back and talking to their kids or asking friends now that are adults and comparing and contrasting, I believe my relationship with Heavenly Father was really strong. I mean, super strong. To the point that I would feel promptings and I would feel answers to prayers and I would feel guilt when I would do bad things, and I thought that was the Spirit telling me that things are wrong, like that you need to do that better, Benj. I constantly felt those things. I always felt like it was never good enough. Always.
For him?
For everything. But I always felt like he loved me and that I was going to get there. Always felt that. I always felt optimism amongst my guilt. I never felt like all hope was lost.
Did you turn to him in hard times?
Always. Always.
And you felt like he was there for you?
Always. I never felt like he wasn't there. Never in my life. Never. And so I always had a very deep-rooted connection with the divine as a child. I always did. And I'm not the kind of kid that talks to himself. I don't do that. I didn't have the imaginary friends growing up. So it wasn't like I would have this, like, talking to Jesus sitting on a couch moment. It wasn't like that ever, any way, shape, or form. But I would have great moments like that. And there were moments where I would feel maybe an inclination, like, I hope I don't go gay. And I would pray for Heavenly Father to give me strength at 12. You know, and yeah, I mean, I would feel that back then. And so prayer has always been an integral part of my life. Even though I felt guilty that I felt like I should have done it more, but I always did it. Looking back, I was a pretty good prayer. And I think I always had very well-versed prayers. I was very open and honest in my prayers, always, amongst my family or within myself, always.
What about scriptures?
Scriptures, I loved them. With my attention span growing up, it was very difficult to do it. It wasn't until I had a really awesome spiritual experience that I decided to take Gordon B. Hinckley's challenge to read the Book of Mormon in 1 year, and I did it.
What age?
I was 16. And we had this thing. This is a really cool experience, and this actually changed my life. It's what made me decide to go on a mission. I always wanted to go on a mission, I think, for the wrong reasons, to prove people wrong. At one point, a lot of my cousins, people in church would always say, you know, you're either one, it was always, you're too talented of a dancer, you shouldn't go on a mission. Lord has given you great talents, use them, don't deny them. You can't dance on a mission. I'm thinking, I'm going to prove you wrong, I'm going to go on a mission just to make you crazy. I would do that. I would think that in my head all the time. Or a lot of people said, you know, you're too out of the box to be a good Mormon missionary. You shouldn't represent Jesus Christ the way that you act and behave. And I wasn't foul. I wasn't like that in any way, shape, or form. It was just that I'm different. I was loud. I sang. I was boisterous. I would dance down the halls. You know, I would play with the kids. And but we did this thing called Mission for a Day. And at the time, we just moved to a new city called Redlands, California, and which is where I live now, actually. And Redlands is a different kind of community. There's a Mormon temple there now built.
What's it near?
It's
Is it east of
in
LA?
In between east. It's east of LA, south of LA, north of San Diego.
Okay.
So, California.
Yep.
L.A., San Diego, Redlands, somewhere in that crust. And so we moved to Redlands because Moreno Valley at the time started getting to be a little crime infested. And it's a really expensive town. It's this old school vibe. And everyone's fed with a silver spoon. A lot of rich people live there. I mean, really wealthy people live there. And I'm like, why are we moving to this place? You know, I don't mind living in Moreno Valley where we do okay for ourselves theoretically. But my parents wanted to open a nice dance studio with paying clients. And they wanted to actually open up a really good place. And so we decided to finally move. We found a great deal through a student of ours that kind of basically gave us his house for next to nothing because he liked us in trade for dance lessons for life. So thank you. You know, and we had a cool house and I went to the school and instead of being made fun of for being a dancer and weird, people actually were okay with it. The arts are really supportive in the city. But I was actually brutally made fun of for being poor. Really bad. Luckily, I only went to school for 6 months. I was 15, sophomore year of high school, and I finished. I was already 2 years ahead, and I just took an independent study thing for a couple of months to finish off all the credits, and I...
You graduated high school at 15?
Yeah, 15 and a half.
Wow.
Yeah.
And there was a missionary thing.
Yes. So because of that, I had a lot more time to actually go to seminary, go to school, go to church, and I hated my ward, though. The first day of my ward, I actually got into a fist fight.
Whoa.
With a boy that made fun of me because my church clothes were shabby.
Oh, wow.
And so. he had like the bow tie. He was like, my dad's a lawyer. I'm going to be a lawyer. One of those things. And I'm like, well, I'm going to be an anesthesiologist. I'm going to overdose you the next time you come into my operating table. But anyways, so he and I became really, really close friends. I'm going to have dinner with him sometime this week. And we became missionary companions of all things too. Which is kind of
wow.
Yeah. But anyway, so I was invited to go to this Mission for a Day thing. And at the time, there was a tempting moment that I had. We discovered the internet. And I found this place. There was a website where you could chat with other gay teens. And I thought that was really interesting, you know. And I thought, well, I don't have any friends in this new city, right? No one at church. Definitely no one at church. I need to find friends. And it was almost like this, is anyone like me out there?
Why gay teens? So by 15, you were... wondering.
I was definitely wondering. Like, I would like girls, but I definitely like guys in the back of my mind. And it was slowly taking over the balance ratio of like 80% girls, 20% boys, pushing it aside to, ooh, we're tipping the scale a little bit now. And but again, I was completely ignorant of it. Like, I would go in on a gay chat site, right? But I wouldn't identify myself as gay. Because, you know, they would ask, what are you? Questioning, curious. Oh, curious. That's it. I'm not gay. But
you would say that,
yeah,
and think you were thinking
believe that.
Okay,
I thought I was going to get married in the temple, but
okay,
just chatting with people. And there was a boy that I'd met. He was my age. He lived 25 minutes away from me, and we actually decided that we were going to go meet. And I was going to take a bus. And I've never lied to my parents at the time, but I was going to lie to them and say I'm going to a church activity. And ironically, there was this thing called Mission for a Day. Right? And the Mission for a Day experience was you actually get a real missionary companion. You go to this fake MTC for a day. You meet the real mission president. He teaches you yada, yada, yada. It's really cool, actually. They give you a really cheesy plastic name tag. I loved it. I thought it was really cool. All my cousins had just gotten back from their missions, and I actually liked the idea of going on a mission. And but then that night, right? Well, the next day was the day I was going to go meet this boy. So I figured, Dad, can you drop me off? But I'll get a ride there the second day, right? And that was like my master plan. And so I'd saved up some money from teaching lessons at my dance studio. I was going to buy this bus ticket and meet him there. And this kid's mother was really supportive. She was going to pick us up then and take us on a dinner date at like 15 or 16.
LDS kid?
No.
Okay.
I think he was Jewish.
Okay.
I don't remember. I don't know.
She was supportive of him being gay?
Totally. He was totally out. He worked for like a GLBTQ, like community center, volunteer. I think he was my age 16. And I thought he was super cute at the time. You know, it was kind of weird. But yeah, we were going to do it. And so I was going to go on this Mission for a Day thing that night. And then the next day to this gay date.
Rendezvous.
Yeah, so weird. So I ended up... that night, I was really excited about it. I'm like, I'm going to play this role. I'm going to go to mission for a day. And at the very end, there was this invitation by the mission president. And he's like, there is someone in this room. You know those really powerful talks that you get? MTC, it has it all the time. There is someone in this room that's not worthy to be here. And it was really powerful to me. And I thought, that's obviously me. And every boy in that room probably felt it going through puberty at the time. It's true, right? We have laughing in the room right now. It's awesome. And I ended up feeling really impacted by that, obviously. Guilt was a big factor, obviously, in all of our lives growing up. And
Did he ask you to stand up or raise your hand or what?
No. He didn't say stand up, raise your hand if you're guilty to be here or whatever.
Oh, wow. So he used it as a technique for each person to think that that was them.
Yes. It was one of those, not come see me in my office now, but rather the Lord, you know, feels like you are going to represent Jesus Christ tomorrow for a full day. And the missionaries have to live by a standard. So for a full day, you need to live by that standard. But tonight, you need to repent and ask the Lord if you're worthy to serve a day mission. And it was like profound for me, right? And so I had this weird thing. Well, and I'm like, okay, that night I get home to my room and I decided to pray prayer again. And I'm on my knees kneeling and I'm praying in my little room. And I remember asking Heavenly Father, what do I do? I feel really pulled right now. I feel like no one accepts me at church, being different. I've never done anything bad since my baptism. I'm a good boy, you know. I love thee. I love the church. I love going to church. But I also really feel this awesome connection. And my parents, we would talk on the phone, this boy and I. They're like, oh, it's your friend Eric from school. I'm like, yeah. I'd hide, you know, in a closet, literally and figuratively, and talk to him and crush on him big time, you know. At the time, we didn't have cell phones, really, so it was like family phone, and I was like, walk around and undo the other phones in the house to make sure no one could hear my conversation. And my sister would do that as a little girl. She would be like, hey, talking to you. Shut up, Lace. And anyways, so I prayed that night, and I didn't feel anything. So my decision was, I'm going to go meet this boy. Bus ticket in hand, you know. And I remember that night I had this dream, right? I'm not gonna go Lehigh. Well, actually I'm gonna go kind of Lehigh on people right now, but I had a major dream. And but I haven't ever had a spiritual dream before. It's not something that I've ever had very often. I would have random dreams, I would sleepwalk sometimes, but I never had like a dream that ever made sense. My dream is this. I literally am in my bed, my body like floats up and looks at it like I'm out of body, you know. And I remember all of a sudden, like scene two, I'm in this white bright place and there's a big golden gate in front of me, and there I don't see faces, but I just see a long line of people, and they all had different kind of glowing energies around. This is going to sound really trippy. I promise I'm not that crazy, but I do need to explain this because it did influence me. I was in this line and little by little people were going, and I couldn't see what was going on, right? But then little by little, I could see a big door. I saw three doors. A big one, and I couldn't see what was in it yet, but they would open every now and then. And people would walk to three different doors. They would cross a line, and then you would see one of these doors open for them. Right? And I mean, talk about like, you know, celestial, right? And I'm like, whoa, okay. And then finally, I got it. And I'm realizing that these people are being judged. I died somehow in my sleep. Who knows how? And I remember even thinking, like, did I have an aneurysm? Like, did what happened to me? Did someone kill me to get bit by a black widow? But I remember, like, seeing, like, okay, I'm dead. Like, this stinks, man. Like, wow, you know? That maybe the Lord killed me before I could make a mistake. So maybe that's a good thing. And so I'm now at the point, like, I'm being dragged. Like my body's flying towards this line of judgment. And then I could see all three doors, and I could see what was behind them. And the big door to my left, I remember this, it was like a giant movie theater. And there was just thousands of people, and they were screaming, and there was blood, and they were throwing popcorn at each other, and fighting, and like ripping their clothes off. And it was so violent and scary. Like, I was like, I don't want to go there, you know? And then there's this other place that was a bit farther off on the right-hand side, and it was like this weird Zen Japanese temple place. Like, talk about weird imagery here, but people that would walk there would neither be, like, aggressive or sad or screaming, but they weren't ultimately happy. They were just, like, neutral. And then every once in a while, there would be a person that would walk through the farthest door, the center door, which was golden. And it was very far away. And every time it would open, it would illuminate the room that we were in. Right? So, mind you, we didn't even have like a celestial, terrestrial study that day at the MTC thing. It was all about preaching the gospel and simple stuff. But I remember realizing, oh, I don't want to be judged right now. I don't think I'm good enough. And I crossed there, and all of a sudden, I just felt that that door opened. And all of a sudden, I saw these hands open up. And I saw the other door open, and I saw the other door open. And it literally, I see two hands with holes in them doing this. Like, choose your own adventure, Benji. Right? So the next day, I wake up, and I'm on the floor sweating. Like, what just happened to me? I didn't realize that. I woke up like in a ball, like the fetal position, like a movie. Like I'm there sweating and I wake up and I'm like, oh my gosh. Right? And so literally like I had 5 minutes to like get to like the rendezvous point to go on this mission for a day. And like, I remember like our power went out in the house. My alarm clock didn't set off. My dad's car broke down. We needed to use a neighbor's car. Like all these things happened. I'm thinking Satan's really trying to fight it here. Like for the first time I could see the powers at hand playing. And I really associated that with gay, devil, straight, heavenly. Like that was very profoundly clear in my head from that moment on. And so I went on a mission for a day. I had a fast and testimony, meaning like it was the most like profoundly spiritual experience that I've ever had up until that point in my life. And I knew I was going to go on a mission. I started reading the Book of Mormon that very next day, graduated seminary. I went to church every Sunday, paid my tithing after every dance competition or paycheck, and never failed up until that point. Very devout, had great callings, served everywhere I could. Yeah.
And you stood up your friend.
I did. He got so mad about it too. He wouldn't talk to me for years. Until I was on a little TV show and he sent me a MySpace message. I'm thinking, don't out me. He's like, you know, your secret's safe with us, man. It's kind of funny.
So before we dive into the mission, any other youth or childhood experiences that you think were really important or formative for what we're going to talk about next? Or do you think we got it?
I think we got it. I do just want to also, though, convey that my parents, however not hyper, like cookie-cutter Mormon they were always very sensitive to things that were spiritual. Were always, they would always talk about good things. They would always mention the church. My parents would always defend the church to bitter end. When even gay people would say, you know, you don't accept us there. Or when something would happen, they would always, like this upheaving, like I will defend honor Christian soldier the heck out of this. I'm like always. And so from an early point on in my life, I had a sense of pride, a good sense, a healthy sense of pride about my faith and my heritage of me being a member of the church. I really did. Even though we faltered a lot as a Sunday Mormon family, as some people called us, but I really loved it. And I just knew that there was a lot of hypocrites in church and I didn't have to worry about that. I didn't go for their approval. I went there because I devoutly and divinely and truthfully loved it. I really, really loved it. Loved the experience, loved my classes, loved staying all 3 hours. I loved the sacrament. I loved the sacrament more than anything, like the sacrament prayers and rebaptizing myself every week was something that I felt I truly needed being so imperfect.
So you're a Mormon boy to the core.
Card carrying.
All right.
Yeah.
So your mission.
Yeah.
Talk about some experiences or what it meant to you or how it informed the rest of your life.
To this day, I my mission has been the most paramount, beautiful experience of my life to this day. And I can look back with the most fondest of memories, the most difficult of memories. I was challenged a lot in my health.
What were you called?
I was called to Oaxaca, Mexico, M-A-M-A-O as we call it in Spanish. And Oaxaca is a southern indigenous area of Mexico. Half the people speak Spanish, half are in one of 17 Indian dialects that are spoken there. So definite Mesoamerica for any of those farms fanatics. The
Lamanites.
Lamanite territory all the way.
Did the missionaries think of it as Lamanite territory?
Oh, we all did. Yeah. I spoke a few of the dialects, in particular one called Mije. And I spoke it fairly well at the time. Now don't even try it, but there was a couple of words that we would translate and compare to, like, this city could be this city, and this in Hebrew means that, and this is kind of related to Hebrew. And we were like, we would really reach for some things that were kind of interesting. And to this day, some of it's like, well, that does have some connective reason. And so I truthfully believe that I was at the time in the land of the Book of Mormon all the way. And we knew it.
So what did you love about your mission?
I loved the fact that I didn't walk in there with a label or a stigma other than elder. You know, I think we were all really at an even playing field, and we were in such a foreign land that was so different to everybody there. What I loved is it didn't matter how much money you made. Like the church is really good about evening out that playing field and really understanding that we're all equals. I really loved that. I really loved that experience of true equality, where it didn't matter what your background was or what your past was. You were there, you were purified by the mantle, and the power of preaching would have forgiveness of your sins and reap salvation for not only others but for yourself. Like, all those things, I think, played really important roles in my life. And I knew from that time I was 16 that I was going to be on a mission. And I had a girl that was kind of waiting for me, and this and that, who dear John me, thank heavens, and he's wonderful. But there's a lot of things that I had. I was sick a lot on my mission.
Did the people love you?
Yes.
And did you love being a missionary?
I loved it.
Were you like obedient and hardworking? Talk about that.
Super obedient, super hardworking. I was like a white handbook, like pro at it. And I was so obedient. The part of my hair was perfect every day. To this day, like, I shake my hair and it just goes that way. Like, I have to fight a part every now and then. Sometimes just let it happen. But, to make a long story short, to make a long 2 years short, I love the people, and I learned more from that group of humble people than I think they ever learned anything from me.
Did they take to your personality?
They did.
To your showmanship?
They loved it. They loved the color. They loved the fact. Oaxaca is a very colorful place. That's where the Day of the Dead was created. So you see, like, all those crazy painted skulls, and they're so poor, and they would take care of the missionaries. Like, we were like, even if you weren't LDS, people loved us. And in particular, one city, like, we even had, like, these gang members give us protection if we ever got beat up by drunk people. And we used to get beat up all the time. Like, we used to get rocks thrown at us, and a lot of cantinas, a lot of bars there, a lot of depression. So that does happen. But I loved every minute, even every punch that I got from somebody, every door slammed. I mean, it was wonderful.
Did your mission president like you?
My mission president and I, like, when I met him, he met me. I didn't speak any Spanish. He didn't speak any English, right?
He was a native.
Native. And Presidente, he, like, for some reason in that interview, like, I spoke great Spanish. I understood every word that he said. And even, like, I remember he giving me the gist. He's like, we're going to send you to a really bad spot, but it's only because the Lord has a lot of faith in you. And I always felt like that was really cool. If he said that to everyone, maybe it was a motivating thing. I don't know. But I loved it. And I was always happy to wake up in the morning, get ready, sing the hymns, have devotional. I loved it, probably because I didn't have that structure in my family life. We never had the family home evenings, and I would love to get the families together and have activities at the church. And, membership was really falling bad, and retention was terrible back then in that era, in that time, at least in that area. It was really bad for our mission, and we were one of the least successful Mexico missions, so it wasn't like we were baptizing hordes of people and just, you know.
What would you average a week, a month?
Well, me or what my mission did, because I was a pretty darn good missionary. I don't honestly remember. I can name all the people probably still that I did, because they always say you have to remember their names, not the numbers. So I still to this day will hold my mission honor code and not say the amount of numbers, but the mission would only maybe baptize 80 a month, whereas like the three missions around us were baptizing 300.
Okay.
So it was pretty bad. It was also a very religiously diverse place. But I did really, I was a fairly successful, like, my mission president called me El Bautizador, the baptizer. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, so I did pretty good in that. I was pretty successful elder. Almost all, with the exception of a couple of, like, mean-spirited elders that didn't even want to be there, everyone loved me, and I loved everyone.
So you felt accepted?
Completely.
So that was different.
Wacky as I was. Yeah, my mission president thought, this kid's a little crazy. He used to say, he's like, Elder, you're crazy, but I love it.
Just because of your energy and passion and creativity.
Yeah, he's like, as long as you're worthy, these are the characteristics that God gave you to serve his kingdom. And I truthfully believe that. And I believe that, I think that helped me maintain a sense of who I was, even while on a mission. Because some people can go into robot mode on their missions, and I didn't. Although I didn't tell any of my companions that I ever danced, unless something would happen. Like, it would happen every now and then where, like, I would do something as an activity. At one point, I did a volunteer work where I choreographed for a high school a dance piece to the song Thriller. I got permission from my mission president to do it as a service project. I got recognized by the governor. He wrote me like this certificate of appreciation. It was pretty cool. They won like this dance competition, like the statewide. And
you weren't known as a dancer by the missionaries.
No, until that happened. And then they started calling me, like, there's a song in Spanish called Sergio Bailador, which means like Sergio the dancer or whatever. So they started calling me Elder Sergio.
The missionaries?
The missionaries, okay, yeah. Okay. And a lot of the members too. But you know, whatever. I didn't care. And I was goofy. Like, I played with the kids, you know, and that identity was really cool. And I think because I didn't feel like I was an outsider, because I felt like these were divine gifts and personalities and characteristics given by Heavenly Father and my premortal spirit. And I felt like I owned up to it. Like, and it was really cool. And from there on out, I always did. I think finishing off, like, the mission was wonderful. There were some really bad, tumultuous moments where I nearly died. Two moments where I was next to death and had some really bad health issues. Really, 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 really bad health issues. And I remember there's one point that I learned, and this is the very first time that I never truly, I believed in, that I lost my belief in infallible servitude and leadership in the church. My mission president, who I literally idolized, was a spiritual giant to me. At one point, he had made this mention. He's like, Elder, you know, you've been zone leader for the longest time. You've done this. Like, I've done everything but become an assistant. And I didn't really want to be an assistant because they had to do a lot of paperwork. And I'm like, I want to be out in the field. But to finish it, lo and behold.
So you were a zone leader.
I was everything. Yeah. They called me El Conejo at one point because I trained more elders than anyone, which means rabbit. And I kept popping out kids. So I think I trained 8 kids, which is awesome. We call them kids, hijos. So I trained a lot of missionaries because I was always animated, as they say. I was always up and I wasn't depressing and I was never trunky, or they call muerto, dead, on the mission in Spanish. I goofed around and I played around, but I was always very obedient, always home by 9:30, always doing what was right. And I remember I even had a couple of gay companions that would confess to me. I never said anything about my issues, right? I can never do that. But they would talk to me and confess that they suffered from that. And they
would say
that. I told them it's something you just have to fight, Elder. Like, this is a trial and it's not your divine self.
You didn't disclose.
Never.
Wow.
There was one boy that I told in my whole mission because he confessed to me. And looking back now in retrospect, we didn't see each other. The first day of getting into our mission, we had to draw straws to see who would sleep on the balcony on a hammock because there wasn't enough beds to fit in the mission home. And so, of course, I just volunteered, and this kid drew like the short end of the straw. So we were staying up there, and I heard him weeping in his bed. I'm like, do you miss your family, Elder? And he's like, no. He's like, I'm feeling a little guilty about something. He told me that he was attracted to men. And he was the only person where I vaguely...
I can't imagine admitting that to a missionary.
No, right?
I mean,
right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it was bad. And I remember at one point I ended up saying, I don't remember how I said it. I kind of tiptoed around it. I didn't deny it with him because I felt like I can't be dishonest. But with him, I almost was like, I wanted to be so empathetic and charitable to him. And I felt like I let him know, like, I kind of said, you're not the only one that goes through this. And I kind of gave that look like I go through it, but I didn't say it. And we hugged and we embraced and it was awesome. He went to bed and I didn't see him for a huge part of my mission. There'd be 18 hour bus rides to get to one area, one zone from the mission. And so I saw him right after I had a major surgery, and he had the same major surgery at the same time. And I remember we both had to get checked by this special doctor, and we both had something we thought was cancer, which wasn't, thank heavens, but it was something pretty bad. It's really a gross story, so I won't get into that detail. But I remember he and I both had to be in front of this doctor, and we both had to, like, kind of strip naked, which is really weird, and we both had to get checked. And it was really awkward because we both kind of knew about each other, and here we are, like, really weird. And we thought, why do we both have the same illness, right? So weird, which is very uncommon there, I guess, apparently. Why are we both having to get the same surgery? And we thought, this is kind of ironic. Why are we both ones that are tempted with, like, the gay thing, right? Or same gender attraction, as you all thought about it at the time. And we always kind of thought that was kind of ironic and funny. Now, he's married with kids now. He's great.
To a woman.
Yeah, he's more attracted to his wife, and I believe him. He's wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man. And to this day, we still talk, and it's wonderful. But I remember there's a moment on my mission where we were literally neighboring ward boundaries, and we were like a block away from each other. And man, I love going on splits with him. I love going on splits. And there was this moment, I would never admit it back then, but I was just like, drawn to him. So drawn to him. The same way that I was drawn to boys at a young age before adolescence ever hit. It was never sexualized. Never romanticized either. Never. Never. Like, looking back, he's not even my type. But I just
love and respect.
Loved him dearly. And wanted to spend every waking moment. Wanted to write him letters on my mission. You know? And it was never mushy. It was just like, I miss him. Like, I looked at the pictures that we developed of one another, like, on our P-Day. Looking back now, I was crushing major, you know? And I connected with somebody, I think, on a deeper level, too, which is rare. But I put that aside.
So what did you tell these other elders that told you about their same-sex attraction? You were going
to
say...
I told them to fight it. It's not their natural state, right? It's not them. And I was so far, like, beyond thinking that I would ever be gay... actively gay, and I thought I had a really good containment over it, because the only feelings that I felt were of admiration, never sexual, right? So, you know, I was good, and never broke the law of chastity in any way, shape, or form on my mission. I mean, I was Nephiic in that sense.
Do you mean no masturbation?
Yes, no masturbation. Okay. I know that's been brought up a couple of times on
sure,
podcasts.
Sure, so sure, sure.
Never said masturbation on a public forum.
Well, this is Mormon Stories. We can't have an episode without
saying
the word.
All right, Mosto. All right. Yes, never masturbated on my mission. Yeah. I had companions that would confess that they did. You know, it was one of those things. And since I was always zone leader or district leader or trainer, like, I always got that from a lot of my companions. Not all of them, but some of them. And never did. Never an issue for me.
Right, right.
I was pretty good about that. Lo and behold, I think that was one experience that was weird. But my mission president, when I got sick, said, you know what's weird, Elder? I was going to call you. And at the time he said call, which I always thought they were assignments. I thought our calling was to be missionaries, to preach the
You were a geek. Look at that.
Yeah, I was a Mormon. I was a missionary nerd. I was John, by the way, of a new generation. Like, I was that missionary. And, yeah, but, you know, whatever. But he even said, you know, I was going to call you to be my assistant. He alluded to that in an interview. He asked me the first question when I found out I was sick and I had to get a surgery. He said, what did you do? That's what he said. So he equated my being sick to unworthiness.
Mm.
And never trusted me again on my mission. Treated
Whoa.
Me like garbage.
Whoa.
And I never did anything wrong in that sense.
Mm.
We're all imperfect people, but I never did anything that would merit that treatment. And it really hurt, because this is one of the first spiritual giants that I really connected with. He connected me. I would write these long, elaborate letters to him, he to me, about doctrinal discussions and this and that. It was just so weird. Mm. It shattered me a little bit.
Mm.
And then I realized I became, like, at the last quarter of my mission, like this rebellious elder, where I was successful. I was breaking records. But President hated me. He sent me to the worst areas. And at that point, it kind of turned into that. I'm going to prove him wrong.
Hmm.
And it was one of those moments where I learned deeply that our leaders are not perfect.
Hmm. But you weren't, like, disobedient.
No, not at all. No, not at all. In fact, I worked harder.
Just personality clash.
Yeah, I lost faith in that leadership. But I believe that the Lord is my true leader in that moment. So it didn't really matter.
You weren't mad that you were an assistant.
No, I could care less. I kind of theoretically did, because I healed in a different mission for over a month after the surgery, had a bad accident in the hospital. And so I kind of had to work in the office, and I gave meetings to the new incoming missionaries 2 or 3 times. I gave talks and firesides there while I was healing in Mexico City.
Mm.
So I theoretically was, and they call me their third assistant.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of ironic. And I'm like, hey, it's prophecy come true.
Any big spiritual experiences on your mission? Or
huge. I had big spiritual experiences. I did.
Did you feel like you knew the church was true?
Yes. That was something, you know, I've heard you talk
about. Talk about your testimony at
yeah,
that time.
My testimony was solid, rock solid. I mean, it was, I believed in everything. Nothing that I didn't doubt. Nothing. I believe in the veracity of the Book of Mormon. I believe that I was standing on Book of Mormon soil. I believe I was living in Alma 47 or 44, where it talks about Hair Mounts or Hair Mounts in English, which is the city that I thought was called Tehuantepec, which is where I served. So hair, ravenous beast, mount, mountainous plain, field. I lived in a place called Tehuantepec. The Te was mean ravenous beast in our dialect. Tepec means mountainous range. Yet it was flat because through Nephi 11, the fields changed, mountains became flat. I mean, I was on it. River Sidus, there was no water there because it changed at 3511. Like, I was pinning all of that stuff together. Like, I may be a dancer and count to eight, but I was a pretty damn smart missionary, you know? And or at least doctrinally, I was really good at being an apologist. Theoretically, at that time, everything that was brought up to me, any doctrine discussed. And I even had a morning talk show, my last area of my mission. The bishop at the time did this morning talk show, and he let me weekly have a discussion with me, a Pentecostal leader, and a Catholic, the leader of the Catholic seminary, like teaching the priests there, the future priests and deacons and whatnot, and even nuns and monks in all of southern Mexico. And we would have a doctrinal discussion.
Wow.
Once a week. I have the tapes. I don't have them anymore, but my Spanish was pretty good at that time, so people would like, it was great. We were really welcomed in this area. And I think at one point we gave over 100, my last week we gave over 100 discussions or lessons. They were called lessons now at that point. I was the first companionship in Mexico to use the Preach My Gospel book. So, you know, I was a pretty quote unquote decorated elder.
And true believer.
Oh, true
sense.
Blue. Yep. True blue.
All right. So anything else about the mission before we... Was it hard to not dance?
I danced.
Was it hard to not compete or to train or...
No, because I had the...
How did you dance?
Well, I mean, like, every morning you wake up, you have 30 minutes of physical activity. So I do, like, push-ups.
You're like flash dancing?
I mean, geez, I'm like, but dancing, but listening to, like, EFY, you know? Like, completely, I don't know, like...
You would dance for 30 minutes every morning?
No, I would like stretch a little bit, you know, and I would even do like push-ups, but I would do like, I can't do it obviously here.
Pull back.
Could I really quick? Okay.
Yeah, pull it back.
I promise I won't break your microphone, dude. But I would do these things.
Okay, you audio listeners are going to have to switch to the video for this.
Yeah, I'll explain what I'm doing. How about that? I go into a push-up position, but I go into the splits as well. So I would be doing our warm-ups and our exercises, but I would be splitting and dancing at the same time and pointing my toes. We would play soccer on our P days, right? Or court football. But like, I'd be running, and I was a good soccer player. I played soccer 11 years, right? But I would be like leaping and like doing backflips. And I would have my companions and teach them gymnastics. And we'd do like all sorts of crazy lifts and tricks that I do with my swing dance partners. And then I would teach like the sister missionaries how to do it, so they would like help them out. There would always be like one big sister missionary and one little one. So it always worked. But yeah, I mean, I had dance in that element, you know, and it was fun. It was a lot of fun. So I did that. There was traditional, typical, like we called it the Guelaguetza there. There was like typical dances there. And so sometimes for activities, the missionaries, we'd come over and, you know, bring non-members and investigators to learn those dances. And they say, Elder, come and do it. And I'm like, I can't go out there and take a dance lesson, right? So we'd be helping people. But I had a good memory. I could pick up on the steps really quickly. So I'd look at it for 2 seconds and I'd do it. You know, it was simple stuff. But so I had that element there.
Okay.
I didn't miss competing at all, because I was never very competitive. I never wanted to beat people. But okay. I loved performing.
You were performing your whole mission.
My whole mission. But okay. I never felt... But see, when I say performance, I don't feel like it means putting on a face. I truthfully, joyously...
It's bringing people joy.
Loved my mission. I felt like I was serving them, being me. And I think it's a very depressing place to live, economically speaking. Culturally, it was very rich and very rich, way richer than where we live now. But I felt like maybe just to brighten somebody's day, you know, to put a smile on someone's face that doesn't even have any teeth because they can't afford dental work, like that kind of thing. And more than anything, my mission, even now, working with the people and serving them, was still to this day the most amazing experience. And I think I gained a stronger testimony of the church and a knowledge of the doctrine and the gospel more than anything. I think I even said this on my homecoming talk. I learned what charity was, and I learned about love and what we really need in life and what we really don't need in life. I slept in hammocks and lived in mud huts and ate iguana and bugs. It was like total Hakuna Matata status for 2 years. And I nearly died a couple times, and I didn't care. The people had nothing, and they would take care of me before I even had a chance to succor their needs. And I love them so much. I think it inspired me to realize there's so much more to life than a dance competition. There's so much more to life than anything. Because loving one another and being nice to people, and half the friends that I made weren't even members, never accepted the gospel. You know, pretty strong Catholic regimen down there. But I love them nonetheless, and I remember their faces, and I remember how their hands felt when we, you know, shook their hands. And so awesome. Such a great experience. The best. So, yeah.
Didn't want to come home?
Didn't. No. Not at all.
Didn't want to come home?
No. In fact, I extended my mission as far as my visa would allow me. Because I was sick for a time, I actually got permission from the government to do it. So I stayed a little longer, which my parents hated. They wanted me home. I think also, maybe subconsciously, and I looking back at it now, that might have been something, but it wasn't the active intention or thought. My parents, the day that I went on my mission, they had promised that they would get their acts together, go full out in the church, and by the time I would get home, within a week, we'd be sealed as a family. And that's something I looked very forward to. Maybe in the back of my mind, I was hoping that in the event that I turn out to be gay or something, that they could save me. You know, I always remember those talks about Joseph saying, even if Emma went to hell, you know, I'd be worthy enough or big enough to go down there, snatch her, and bring her to the celestial kingdom with me. And, you know, I thought about that. When a Child Wanders, I read that book, and I thought about that sometimes too, or for my other friends as well. And there was at one point, I got the letters of, like, family pictures stopped coming, and I knew something was wrong. And I was kind of, my parents didn't want to say anything because they wanted to let me focus on the mission, which was great. But I worried about them, and I knew that things were bad. And the only time I got to hear about this was the day it was me and my mission president got in that discussion where he lost all faith in me and thought I was a heathen. And I'm on my mission. I just had that accident at the hospital, and I'm sitting here, and I found out I was kind of Dear John at the time, that same day. And like all, just like the world went to poop completely, utterly. And I had like six families, like, with their goal to be baptized that week, and they all dropped because I wasn't there, and it was bad. It was a bad day.
And you found out about your...
And I found out through my sister that my parents were separated. Dad was living in elsewhere. They haven't gone to church in over a year.
And you knew that when he got home, there would be no ceiling.
Yeah, and I felt like, okay, I need to work even that harder now because I need to reap the benefits. I won't even take the blessings for myself. I'll fend for myself, but I will work harder. I want my parents to be okay and sealed. That was one of the goals. I'm going to come back just this beacon of spirituality and power and get my folks to shapen up. Gosh, what an awful perspective to have, I think. You know, my parents are awesome. They're the coolest people ever, and they're the coolest divorced people ever. We have a family dinner once a week, just us four, my little sister, myself, and my parents.
Oh, it's your parents.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fee.